Hello, thank you for coming to the Anti-Spyware Coalition session. This may be the only semi-traditional panel at Black Hat this year, and we're going to do two of them. In the first half of the day, we are going to, the first panel, we're going to focus on kind of where is spyware today, what are people seeing out there, how are companies dealing with it, how's the enforcement going. And then in the second panel, we're going to focus on the future and what do people expect to see. We've got a great set of speakers today. Wish I could say I rounded them all up, but I didn't. Nico Sell did a lot of the work. I'm going to introduce them one by one. I'm not going to read their bios because you have them all in your book, from what I could tell, but they're not in the order that they're going to speak. So I'm going to have to introduce each one individually before they speak to let you know where to look in their bio. My name is Ari Schwartz. I am Deputy Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology. We lead the Anti-Spyware Coalition, give a quick introduction to the Center for Democracy and Technology for those that don't know us. We're a nonprofit advocacy organization based out of Washington, D.C. We focus on civil liberties issues, privacy, free expression, and trying to keep the Internet open and decentralized. So there's actually a good 10-year history of our organization on this table for those that want to follow up on it, and some other paper from CDT and from ASC that I'll refer to in a little bit. So let me launch in a little bit to just give a quick intro into where we stand today in spyware and what my organization is working on and how the Anti-Spyware Coalition got here. Just quickly, how is spyware affecting people? What does it mean to people? 2/3 of IT administrators and security administrators say spyware is now the top network security threat. According to WatchGuard, 55% of enterprise computers have instances of spyware, according to Gerhard's company Webroot. I think that Gerhard's going to be kind of showing some more statistics along those lines, going into more detail in the same area. And then 61% of consumers now have spyware on their computer. That's down from 80%, according to the National Cybersecurity Alliance in a study that they've been doing with AOL. They found 80% the year earlier, the December earlier, and this was this past December that they came up with the 61%. We attribute that drop directly to the increase in anti-spyware software on people's computers, the numbers have gone down since most spyware researchers have actually seen the number of threats continue to increase. So why do we care about spyware? Just to list a few of the issues, identity theft being high on the list for keystroke loggers and other kinds of threats that steal information, corporate espionage along those same lines. We've seen some criminal cases involving domestic violence where the batterers have placed keystroke loggers on people's computers, et cetera. Extortion cases, similar to the corporate espionage cases. And then general fraud, unfair and deceptive trade practices. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about what the FTC has been seeing in that area. And then general privacy and invasions and harm to users' computers. So we've focused on a few different areas in fighting spyware, and we're going to try and touch on some of these today. I think throughout the day we'll probably touch on almost all of them. Technology, being the anti-spyware tools, enforcement and forensics, meaning trying to find the bad guys and then enforce the law, the existing law, where it needs to be enforced, advertisers and revenue models, since a lot of it seems to be based on advertising, legislation, where do we need new laws, and polling and education. To help address some of the issues in the technology area, CDT helped to form the Anti-Spyware Coalition. And the Anti-Spyware Coalition came about, a lot of people know the history, but just to give people a little bit of a refresher course, a lot of the spyware companies and adware companies were threatening the anti-spyware companies with lawsuits, saying that they're calling them spyware, basically, and removing and for tortious interference, for interrupting their trade relationship with their customers, with what the spyware spyware companies were calling their customers people whose computers that they're on at that point.
Compromised is the word we're looking for.
Yeah. Well, I'm being a little slightly generous there. The anti-spyware companies had a tough time with dealing with a lot of these complaints because a lot of them came out of the antivirus world where people that write viruses don't usually show up and try and defend themselves to say, oh, yeah, that was my virus that I set out there people want it on their computer. So they don't really have the background to go about doing that, and the standards were built in a different kind of a way, to be brief about it. And so they wanted to get together to form definitions. An earlier attempt to do exactly that had failed, mostly because the coalition was infiltrated by the same spyware groups that they were trying to combat in certain ways. So CDT was approached about trying to set up that kind of a coalition to work on that issue, work with the anti-spyware companies. We were interested in doing it if we could also work with researchers, academics, and public interest groups to try and really flesh out the issues and get at something that could really be considered a true standard. At first, the focus was on trying to get to a risk model. Oh, shoot. But then we decided that we needed more help in the definitions area because there was agreement on about 90% of the terms, but people were using the terms, it's about 10% of the terms to mean different things. So we felt as though we needed to get the definition out there, solve the definitional problem, and then move on. So, and I have the final version of the definition, final working version of the definition on that table as well that we came up with. We had a public comment process on it that a lot of people and some people in this room participated in. Basically, we have a general definition of spyware. I think most people in this room probably take the viewpoint that you know it when you see it. In order to really build a standard out there that we could work from, we felt that we needed to go into more detail. And again, this information is on the table over there, and I want to get to the panelists as quickly as possible. So I'm going to skip through some of the more details, further details here. But the ASC then went through and also built a vendor dispute process so that there was an industry standard for handling complaints when they got them. For a risk model document, as I said, that was the main goal, to try and set up what observable behaviors spyware had. And then tips for consumers and enterprises. We have the tips for enterprises on the table as well over there. We've held two public workshops so far, one in Washington, D.C. that was very well attended, and the chairman of the FTC spoke, Eileen's boss, main boss, spoke, and we've had one in Ottawa as well, and we're planning on having some next year as well. These are the members of the coalition, and if you're interested in getting more information about joining, et cetera, right now membership's limited to anti-spyware companies, people that distribute anti-spyware, academic institutions, and public interest groups. But if you fall into one of those categories or you just want more general information, please come and see me afterwards. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Gerhard so we have enough time to get into the details and get some questions.
Thank you, Ari. Wanted to add on a little bit on to what Ari was talking already in terms of numbers. I wanted to put some numbers behind the spyware problem. But first, before talking about numbers, we need to understand what's out there and how do we know what's out there. I think that's the fundamental question in the spyware space. With viruses, it's pretty easy. You stick out the sensor on the internet and you pretty much know what's going on there. Spyware is pretty hard to track down, and that's a pretty big challenge for the research industry, particularly as the research process or part of the research process is to actively hunt spyware. At the same time, spyware is changing its face pretty significantly every day, every hour, sometimes even every time you visit a website there. So trying to do this in a manual fashion was our initial approach to do so, but we quickly realized that doesn't scale. So we have put over the past 2 years some quite significant infrastructure in an automated facility, in a research facility, that allows us to crawl the internet on a daily basis, 24/7, specifically targeted for malware. So you can think of it as the Google for spyware. And what it allows us to do is obviously to understand where is the spyware threat, how it's changing in a nearly real-time fashion. And we take this data, we spider the internet, browse the internet, and keep this data in a big backend database where we store this information for research, for correlation, and for analysis, and particularly as well to create some of the numbers that I'm going to just walk you through in a minute there. In addition to what we do with this information is we publish our quarterly state of spyware report. That's really much a reflection of what's going on the internet in terms of spyware. This report is actually coming out in about 2 weeks, so the numbers that I'm going to show you today are unpublished numbers, but going to be published in about 2 weeks as part of the Q2 State of Spyware Report update. So let's take a look at the bigger picture here. If you think about it, look at this graph here. This is pretty much the development in terms of malware or spyware sites found by our research infrastructure. And when I talk about research infrastructure, I talk about this big data center infrastructure that sits on the internet in different places and emulates users, fundamentally, browsing websites connected to a big backend database. So you see here, we do about roughly 4 million websites a week that we analyze for spyware particularly. And we don't just broadly apply our search engine or our spider, but we keep it very targeted towards areas we know there is spyware going on, spyware activity going on. So that way we can be pretty effective without rebuilding the complete Google data center. In this past quarter, second quarter, we have identified about 100,000 new sites that are distributing spyware or some kind of a malicious exploit behavior code. That brings up to a little bit over 500,000, half a million sites so far being found. So if you look at those numbers a little bit more detailed, you can then also look at where is the stuff coming from? Where is this pieces of malware, where is this spyware coming from? And it's pretty interesting, actually. In this quarter, the U.S. was by far the biggest contributor to the distribution, the overall spyware distribution. But let's not think that necessarily that all those sites that are distributing spyware actually know about it. So that's not necessarily reflective of the fact that the U.S., that the people who are behind those servers are necessarily sitting in the U.S. The people who are behind those servers could sit literally anywhere on the planet. That's part of the challenge with spyware as well, that you usually have different sites for distribution, and the people who are behind it are usually in different places there as well. Just as it happens, probably a big part of the internet is here in North America, and that's probably part of the reason why a lot of the spyware distribution sites also happen here in the U.S. You also see some sites in Europe, but pretty much the biggest part is clearly in the U.S. here. Now, if you look at these numbers in terms of time over time, we also look at the other side of the medal. We not only look at who are the sources, but we'll also look at the targets. This is data from a target perspective, and basically is a reflection over the past 2.5 years in terms of how many pieces of Trojans or how many computers are infected out in the wild, end users' computers as well as enterprise computers, in terms of how many computers have Trojans on there. Trojans is by any means the smallest numbers of infections. If you look at the bigger spyware picture, including adware, and if you like to add cookies as well, the numbers are obviously much bigger. But I do believe it's important to keep in mind Trojans as being the most malicious forms of spyware here being on the rising edge there. And those are examples of Trojans that we have published, some of them. This is an example we found recently with our research infrastructure through an automated fashion. Very classical scenario, drive-by infection. So you go on a website and your browser is being taken advantage because of a security vulnerability that is not patched in your browser. Classical way of spyware is getting onto computers. The payload in this particular case was a Trojan that's stealing information from online forms. So if you go to a bank, online bank or e-commerce site, the Trojan becomes active, captures the data from your online forms, login information, username, password, but also is capable of capturing a screenshot and then sending it off to a centralized FTP server, as in this case was the case. And when we got access to this server, when we found this piece of spyware. When we found the server, within the first week, about 10,000 people were compromised already. So this is real stuff. This is real. And interestingly enough, those servers organized the data incredibly well. So you see what you see there: social security numbers, credit card numbers, everything organized by country. So pretty much ready for sale. Organized by, in this case, it was over 100 countries. Now, looking at the amount of instances of spyware on a particular machine, if you typically what happens is a machine is not typically infected just with one piece of spyware. Usually you have multi-infections because that's how spyware writers are working. They're trying to get as much as possible infections because maybe if this one doesn't stick, maybe another one sticks, for example. And so you see that the instances of Trojans is always in the range between 1.2, 1.6 instances per infected machine. So that's pretty static, actually. But if you look on the other side, on the adware side, adware is clearly on the decline. While we saw the increase on the malicious part, on the Trojan side, we clearly see a decrease on the adware side. And it's probably part of it that some of those businesses are going out of businesses, and some of those people are refocusing the business. So I think there's probably good reasons why some of the adware is actually getting smaller. At the same time, the amount of malicious pieces are increasing. Last slide, talking about what is the state of spyware today. If you think about it, it's all about improving the distribution and the obfuscation methods. That's really what spyware writers are all about there. Leveraging various vulnerabilities. This year, the first 6 months of this year have been particularly fruitful. There were many, many security vulnerabilities that were not patched immediately. There was many times without patches available. This is clearly the windows that spyware writers take advantage of. But also at the same time, if you think about spyware, it's about targeting the user. It's no longer targeting the machine. In the early days, it was all the worms. When worms were circulating, it was all about targeting the machines. Now it's all about targeting the user through the browser, through the email, and through any other means that are typically client-facing application. Clearly a huge increase in use of rootkit-type technology to stay obfuscated, to stay beneath the operating system. And there is actually a pretty interesting talk here at the conference tomorrow that I'm personally looking forward as well. But also looking at some packing encryption technology being used to really take advantage of being stealth, being under the hood, and not being detected. And again, the main reason, the main purpose spyware is on the market, it's always all about the money. Money is clearly feeding the spyware machine, and that's why the spyware issue is actually a real issue and not just an academic thought. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerhard. Next on our list is Dan Kaminsky, who many of you know. He is from Doxpara Research. Again, the bios are in the book, so I'm not going to go read them again. Dan?
So I have a friend. Friend's name is Tori. Good girl. I've known her for a couple years. And I'm over her place, and I'm talking with her mom. And her mom says, "Oh, Dan, can you take a look at my laptop? It's been broken for a little while." And I say, "Sure, I'd be happy to." And she goes and she takes it out of the closet. And I say, "Why is it in the closet?" And she says, "It's been there for the last 6 months." And I say, "Why?" And she says, "Well, it doesn't work." And predictably, I find out that, you know, this machine had come down with enough spyware and adware that it was effectively useless. And then I thought about it. This was one machine in one closet. There were probably millions of other machines that have been replaced, that have been sent for servicing. Hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars worth of damage have been done. No one went to jail. No one even got sued. If you want to know why spyware happened and why it's continued to be a problem all these years, I have nothing but respect for the level of buy-in that some of the bigger spyware vendors have gotten from the FTC. I mean, other way around, more along the lines of the fact that there have been standards that have been applied to. But if you look at it, you can kind of say it as, you've taken a lot of money, and you've caused a lot of damage. How about you change your ways, and then you don't have to give that money back, and you don't have to go to jail? That's kind of what these guys were told, and that's why this is a continuing problem. It is not actually technically feasible to stop spyware. We can't even stop execution of arbitrary code on game consoles. Game consoles with arbitrary, you know, completely fixed hardware, the most investment in cryptography you can get, and completely fixed software, and these boxes still get arbitrary execution of code. You will not be able to solve this problem technically. We can react for a little while until the rootkits get better. But at the end of the day, the virus authors never came forward and sued, because the virus authors assumed if they ever came forward, they'd go to jail. Because that's what you do to criminals. I think there's been far too little willingness to admit that what we are dealing with is a large-scale organized crime problem. Whatever we've been treating it as, it hasn't been that. Now, in terms of technical terms, there is the issue of back channels. If you think you will be able to stop spyware from communicating back to its sources, we live in a networked society, and your devices have so many ways of going back home. One way that is actually useful to track down spyware on your network, and we have to admit we are all living under limited resources, monitor your DNS logs. I'm serious. You have a couple boxes that everything in your organization goes to. Watch for lookups, and watch for lookups to hosts that seem suspicious and then there's no actual communication there. Because you can, as I've shown, you can move all your communications over DNS. If you are just sort of accepting the existence of spyware on your network by saying, well, you know, it's not really causing a problem, users still being able to get their job done, spyware actively modifies the way that desktops are functioning. Among other things, several pieces of spyware actually full-on add functions to Internet Explorer that are effectively download and install code from URL. Like, that's not a joke. I've pretty much seen that exact ActiveX function marked as safe for scripting from one piece of spyware. So it happens. So if you look at the penetration rates, you actually can foresee with the rest of the ecosystem, you know, with the base operating systems getting more secure, you start seeing what's your best route as an attacker to attack a particular machine. Well, look for how spyware has modified that machine. And I wasn't going to mention this, but it's worth, I unfortunately have to. Who configures that machine? Well, you've got, obviously, the operating system vendor, but you also have the person who sold you the laptop. People pay for stuff to go on laptops. And it's worth investigating, worth being aware of, you know, can a spyware vendor, because they make a lot of money, can they walk over to Dell and say, please put our spyware on this machine? Have they already? I specifically haven't, you know, after the whole Sony thing went down, I pretty much avoided Sony laptops. Not because I knew, because there were certain fights I didn't feel like getting into. In terms of other stuff, it would be useful. You can't stop the matter technically. You can create standards that delineate the field very strongly between this is legitimate code that the user has agreed to run, and this is illegitimate code where we throw people in prison. This is the goal of any kind of rulemaking, to make a very strong distinction. Because right now, as long as everything's gray, no one goes to jail. One thing that would be a very clear and helpful addition would be, if you have code that claims to be legitimate, it must have some visible effect. And you must be able to right-click on the visible effect, and in under 10 seconds, the thing has to die and never come back. You see an ad you don't like, you right-click it, it goes away. You see a pop-up that appears to be part of something else, you have to know where it came from. We do this for political ads. I approve this message. You need to know who approves messages. And you need to have a way to get rid of it. And if that causes side effects in terms of shareware or freeware on your system that doesn't work anymore, you get an opportunity to tell people that. But you have to make it so it is very clear and quick. The fact that we need to have third-party software to remove spyware from machines is a failure, unfortunately. That's pretty much what I got.
Thanks, Dan. That should make things interesting further down the road. Next on the panel is Andre Gold, CISO from Continental.
So it definitely does absolutely make things interesting. I think with most organizations, I mean, Continental's no different. We have a lot of Tories, you know, within our environment as well. We have Tories out at the ramp within reservation centers that utilize their, you know, laptops, their respective desktops for work-related activities, but also find opportunities to do other things, such as find sites and things like that on the Internet by which then represent an attack vector within the environment with the induction of spyware. I think what we've seen over the last 3 years, especially over at Continental is that we no longer face the traditional malware type of demon, i.e. the virus and the worm out of, on the desktop. What we face now is that proliferation of the spyware and the respective adware. In our respective environment, it's caused a lot of lost productivity in the sense that when we're going out there and we're trying to upgrade operating systems, roll out new machines and everything else, what we're seeing is that it's no longer very easy to just upgrade the environment. What we see is that, you know, we're trying to figure out ways in which we can combat and then remove the large amounts of spyware that are resident on the machines. At times, we're able to circumvent that and get into process earlier. A lot of times, we're not. And the reason why is because, you know, if a user can still do their job, if they can still be productive to the environment, then a slow machine is okay, especially if they've caused the machine to be slow in and of itself. And so it is unfortunate that we have to use third-party software, but, you know, from my perspective, we have to do what we have to do to combat the threat. Right, it's not a technology issue. It'd be a lot easier to elevate what I call the security IQ of our employees and everything else. I mean, you get flyers in the mail each day that say, hey, you know, you've won a cruise to such and such, and you've got all these other things, but a lot of people don't call the respective people now and say, hey, where's my free cruise and everything else? But yet and still they go to bad sites and say, okay, I'll click on this because it looks interesting and I've won an ad, and oh, by the way, now I've installed spyware, but hey, I don't want to tell anybody, and, you know, I can continue to work. So with that being said and everything else, we are looking at to try to take advantage of technology, third-party technology, as best we can. And part of that process looks at maximizing the footprint that we have on an existing machine out there. I think over time what's happened, especially from an operational perspective, is that desktops and laptops are no longer, you know, just simply productivity tools, but there's a huge amount of management overhead that you have to deploy on that respective asset to combat, you know, these new and evolving threats. And so what we're trying to do is looking at how we can maximize the investment that resides on that asset to begin with to combat some of the spyware, adware, you know, type of things that are out there.
Thanks, Andre. Last we have Eileen Harrington from the Federal Trade Commission.
Thanks, Ari. Thanks, Dan. Let me tell you quickly what we're doing at the Federal Trade Commission in the spyware area and what we're not doing and what we can do and what we can't do. The FTC's job is not to be a cutting-edge research organization that is able to recite on any given day exactly what the latest developments in the spyware world are. That's not our function. We don't have those resources. That's what Gerhard and others do. And very generously share their training and expertise with us. Our job is to develop policy and draw lines and get it right, not get it wrong, in terms of trying to set some policy in this area. In the policy development area, our first challenge is to develop the intellectual capital that's necessary to understand what is happening in the marketplace, so that as we work at developing policy, we do it from an informed perspective. In 2004, we did a public workshop on spyware. In 2005, we issued a report. In 2006, in the fall, we'll be holding 4 days of public hearings in Washington on a host of issues relating to protecting consumers in the next decade, and spyware will certainly be chief among those issues. We think it's especially important for us, in terms of the FTC's mission, to be watching the adware space. A lot of the practices that we're hearing about here are criminal. You're right, Dan. And the Federal Trade Commission is not a criminal enforcement agency. We don't have that authority. The Department of Justice is the other key part of the enforcement regime here. Keystroke loggers, ID theft, all of the stuff, or most of the stuff that Ari displayed on his slide at the outset, those practices are covered by criminal statutes, and those are enforced by the Department of Justice. The FTC's main law enforcement focus is on unfair and deceptive trade practices. That's what the law that set us up tells us to focus on and gives us the authority to go after. In that, using that authority, we've brought 6 cases to date against spyware purveyors. Those cases have charged those purveyors with deceptive practices for product claims that they've made, for example, about the existence of spyware on your computer or about the ability of a product that's being sold to remove, detect spyware. Deceptive practices for offering free shareware or freeware without disclosing that it comes bundled with spyware. False removal claims, those are the kinds of practices that we've gone after using our authority to challenge deceptive practices. We've also alleged unfair trade practices for drive-by and other kinds of download practices where there is significant harm. That's what the law requires that we be able to prove. We have to prove harm or the risk of harm that's unavoidable and that isn't outweighed by countervailing economic benefits. That's the legal standard. So we've gone after downloads that hijack browsers, that materially alter the operation of the computer, where the software can't readily be uninstalled, where pop-ups are so severe and constant that they really cripple the use of the computer. Those are the six public cases. We have other cases in the pipeline, some that are about to be introduced or announced very shortly. We also have a settlement coming that will be made public when the commission is finished reviewing it. But, for example, in that case, the defendants will have to pay back all of the money that they made off of their activities and will also be operating with a very large suspended judgment over their heads if they've lied about anything or violate the order in the future. You know, I think that that's a significant remedy in terms of the remedies that are available to us under the law. Now, technological solutions. I think what we're hearing from this panel and what I have always heard is that there is no one solution. Technology alone is not going to fix this problem. The law alone is not going to fix the problem. You know, vigilance alone may not fix the problem because the moment that we hit the right degree of vigilance, there's some new scheme. It's all of it together that's needed. Self-regulation is a big part of it. The work that the Anti-Spyware Coalition is doing is very significant. Notice and consent are key in any self-regulatory scheme. We're also encouraged by the trusted download effort. The Direct Marketing Association has issued guidelines which, if actually complied with by their members, would make a big difference in the adware space. And we think at the FTC that a key place for us to keep our eye on is the adware space, because a lot of what's driving practices that affect either, you know, enterprise networks or individual consumers' computers comes up in the adware space. The keystroke logging, you know, identity theft, all that really, really bad stuff we care about. The FTC is also very involved in ID theft issues and privacy. But in terms of our mandate and our statutory authority, we're paying a lot of attention to the development of advertising in the online environment. It's a very fluid situation. There are models that have been tried and that have failed. And it's important that we get it right and not either kill legitimate advertising or allow, in the name of legitimate advertising, practices that are causing enormous harm. And that's a very tough line to draw and a tough balance to get right. Consumer education is another area of activity for us here. We launched this year the On Guard Online campaign. It is not branded to the FTC. It's a comprehensive campaign to educate computer users about a host of threats that they need to take action to guard against. And I can tell you more about it later if any of you are interested, but we have many nonprofit groups that have partnered with us to run this campaign, as well as industry groups. Anybody who has an audience can participate in deploying the materials for this campaign. It's an excellent campaign to help people know what they can do to protect their computers and their personally identifiable information. And finally, we're active on the international scene and are pushing particularly hard for some new statutory authority for the FTC to enable us to do our job better on the international scene because we're somewhat limited. you know, it sounds a little lame to sit up and say, well, there's only so much we can do, except it's the truth. We have to operate within the law, and we have to operate using the authority that the Congress has given us. And there are some key areas where we simply don't have authority. But in a nutshell, I've run through what it is that we are doing with the authority that we have, and happy to answer your questions.
Thanks. So we finished right at the time we were planned, which is unheard of for a panel that I've moderated in the past. Usually everyone goes over. But that's great because then it leads more time for discussion, for real discussion. I hope that you'll join us if you have questions. I'm going to start by asking a few of them. I'm going to take a little bit of a moderator's prerogative to respond to some of the things that were said here. One thing Dan said was no one's gone to jail. It's not 100% true that no one has gone to jail. In fact,
okay, yeah, some 21-year-old kid who doesn't have lawyers behind him and who clearly takes out a health care facility goes to jail. What is it? Direct Revenue makes $100 million a year.
Well, Direct Revenue is being sued by the Attorney General of New York right now. So, and in fact, on the table we also have a report that CDT has done on the current enforcement actions, some of them that are in progress, like the Attorney General Spitzer's case, and some of them that have been settled, like this James and James Anchetta's case. He was running a botnet, and he was just installing, from what I could tell, and just installing Zango and 180 Solution software over and over again, making money every time it was installed. And the quote here, which is one of my favorite all-time quotes, you got to read the discovery documents from these cases, because just all throughout these discovery, I mean, they're smoking guns, like all throughout these, the people have still not seemed to learn that email is discoverable in these cases, and he set himself up here with it's immoral, but the money makes it right. Another case, one that Eileen's group brought, you have another case like that with Sanford Wallace, who said, you know, I found out a way to install an EXE without any user, any action. There's a time to make money while we can. Obviously not extremely technically sophisticated, but significant enough to make over $4 million, according to the FTC, to do that. And again, in the discovery documents in that case, too, I have one up here that I just pulled up while they were speaking. Let me see if I can zoom in here a little bit. So you can see he basically says, he's talking about how, he has guys that are working for him. This is his partner, Walt Rhines, who says the homepage thingy, including the homepage thingy as a DLL, so you will never lose them once you get them. I will pay for the banners, because earlier he says I'm paying 80 cents per thousand banners, per thousand impressions, that I assume that means. And then he says, he glues to the SSH so that he makes sure that he doesn't crash. And then he's going to put all of his exploit stories at this website eventually called royalpaininthease.com. So I actually went to royalpaininthease.com. Not to take us too far off on a tangent here, but definitely relevant. Have you tried this, Eileen?
Yes.
Do you know where it takes you? See if it comes up. So I should also note while this is loading, it seems to be taking a little while.
Wait. Broken networking at a HackerCon? Oh, whatever.
Well, let's see what happens here. Oh, I shut down the other page. But his email address throughout this thing, and it's still his email address from what I understand, is DJ Masterweb. The Royal Pain in the Ass eventually will resolve to OPM Nightclub in Caesar's Palace. So he happens to be working here right now.
I'm looking around the room.
That's a
aren't you?
Yeah. So so that leads. I mean, that sort of leads to the question about. I don't know, Eileen, if you can talk about working with. I mean, here he's basically saying that he was holding users' computers hostage in the emails, et cetera. Working with the Department of Justice in these kind of cases, how that works. If you go in a little bit of detail about that, and also about finding these guys and and getting money. Oh, here it comes. Getting money from them when you do get a case like this.
Well, we work closely with the Department of Justice and with the Computer Crimes Group particularly, and there's not a lot more that I can really say publicly about that. But we do work closely. These are our colleagues. We all know each other well, and our offices are two blocks away from each other. So, and in fact, some of the people who work at Computer Crimes used to work at the FTC. So it's a very close working relationship. You know, finding Gerhard, I was interested and always a little disheartened to hear people like Gerhard say that that finding the people who are behind some of the spyware activities is challenging and sometimes impossible. You know, I would agree with that. At the same time, we've certainly found all of the defendants in the cases that we have brought. We have done the most thorough financial discovery and tracing that we can, and have gotten as much money as we have been able to locate back, where the legal theory is there to get the money back in the first place. There's some challenges with spyware in terms of what the law provides for in the way of financial remedies. The Federal Trade Commission Act gives the Federal Trade Commission the authority to go into court and the court to order redress to consumers. There you have to show that there is some claim or practice that the consumer relies on to their detriment that entitles the consumer ultimately to get their money back. That's sort of like fraud.
So okay. when my friend's mother had to put her laptop in the closet for 6 months.
Right. Let me tell you, we have a lot of people who work at the FTC who've had to put their computers in the closet too. And we've had FTC computers that we've had to put in the closet. So this is you're right. I mean, there are computers everywhere. What I'm talking about here is what the law says and the remedies that are available under the law. One remedy is basically redress or restitution where there's reliance, as is the case where there's fraud. That's hardly ever what happens in a spyware case. So what we have to look at instead is the remedy of disgorgement, of ill-gotten gain. That's a remedy, an equitable remedy. There have been some interesting court decisions recently that haven't pleased us too much in cases having nothing to do with spyware, but cases that the FTC brought, where the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a pretty powerful federal appellate court covering New York State and other areas up that way, said that to get disgorgement, we have to prove that the money that we seek to disgorge flowed directly from the wrong to the defendant who we are suing. As you know, in a lot of spyware cases, there's a whole distribution network, and the money gets split up among all sorts of different players. And the effect of this decision on disgorgement has been quite troublesome to us. Because if you take the court's decision and apply it to a spyware case where you've got a broad affiliate network, what we would have to do is name every single affiliate and trace every dime that is generated to the particular defendant or affiliate from whom we are attempting to obtain disgorgement. So this is a troublesome situation. We don't necessarily think that the court got it right, and that's only in one circuit. But it's very tough to, under the law, to get the kind of financial remedies included in the remedy package. No trouble getting injunctions, you know, because we can show the bad practices that then can provide a basis for the court to say, don't do this anymore. But we all know that saying to people who are doing this kind of stuff, don't do this anymore, in a civil action, is not necessarily the greatest deterrent.
What about criminal trespass?
What about it?
I mean,
it's not in the
FTC's jurisdiction. It's not in most state AG's jurisdictions. It's in the jurisdiction of local prosecutors and the Department of Justice, criminal enforcement authorities. Now, you know, I live, like Ari, in Washington, D.C., where there's a local crime emergency that's been declared, but don't believe it because D.C. is really a nice and safe city. But the police and the prosecutors are all out, you know, rounding up folks who are, robbing folks, you know, pickpocketing and doing that kind of stuff. And every time they're doing that, you know, I can tell you they're not doing it. The District of Columbia Police Department, I don't think, has a spyware unit. you know, this is a problem. It's a problem because you're absolutely right that millions of dollars are being lost when machines are rendered inoperable and networks are crippled. And it's one of a host of issues that are facing basically the same organizations. So what are we going to do? You know, how do you set the priorities? How do you marshal the resources?
Eileen, just to follow up on that, I mean, what can the folks here, the researchers, yeah. researchers and people that work on security, when they come across something,
call.
What can they do?
Call and email. Let us know. You know, we really need you to be the eyes and the ears.
Do you want to follow up on that point?
I bet there's somebody here from an ISP who'd like to try an answer at that.
That was also a real big challenge in the Trojan that I was mentioning here in this example. It took us weeks to figure out, first of all, who is responsible for this machine, because the ISP was not responsible for it. The end user was running the machine within the ISP's host there. So that was a big part of the challenge there, to track that down before we got some action going there. Yes?
Clarification: the difference between spyware from Microsoft or Sony versus spyware from standard computers.
Does someone want to take that, Dan?
Well, if you asking me about spyware from Sony, awesome. There is no difference. I mean, there is a certain set of behavior. It doesn't matter who's doing it. And that was one of the real problems we had during the Sony fiasco. It wasn't just that Sony did what they did. It's that a fair number of vendors, who can go nameless, said, oh, this is Sony. Well, Sony can't do anything bad. Well, that, and they could sue us into a small spot on the ground. So there is no difference between it. If you are behaving in a manner that is violating the privacy or violating the stability of a user's machine, you're liable for it. Yeah. At least, let me put it this way. At least that is the says, you know, I'm an engineer. My goal here is find problems, and if they're illegal, get them forwarded to people for societal enforcement. So this problem lives at the legal technical boundary. We can technically find what we're able to. We can technically remediate what we're able to. But eventually, you know, we can't go around arresting people, although, damn, that'd be fun.
But you know, you are to say that this problem, in its worst iteration, certainly lives at the legal technical boundary is absolutely dead on. It does. It does. And, you know, the people who do it know that. And, you know, the questions for the Congress are whether they want to change the legal boundary. And the questions for researchers and technologists are, how fast can you move the technology boundary?
The only thing that appears that it could work is the blacklist approach is as inflexible and unworkable for, you know, we abandoned blacklists on our firewalls a long while ago. At least most people seem to have. You know, oh, we'll block this. Oh, we'll block that. Oh, we'll block that. There really needs to be a prescribed whitelist of legal behaviors for what is going on here. And anything that deviates from that list needs to be presumed basically criminal unless proved innocent. I mean, that's a fairly significant change, but that's the market we're looking at right now. We're looking at a market right now that is, you know, Granted, it's getting better, and in fact, I've been, you know, reasonably satisfied with the types of efforts I've been seeing, but you're right, it's a jurisdictional issue. You are so constrained in what you can do for
this
problem.
And the other concern is that, you know, is to pay attention to advertising models as they develop in the adware space. It's important to not draw a line that chills protected speech, that deters what could be very legitimate advertising, and that's really hard. I think in this area, we have found, and the FTC has been involved in policing advertising for a long time, and I think that we have found, you know, watching the development of internet advertising models, and there really aren't models that have taken firm root yet. You know, every so many months we see a new model developing and it's tried, and there are sometimes problems and sometimes we have to sue, and, you know, other times things just don't take off. But how is, you know, advertising really going to move in this channel? Because people really want the content and something has to support it. And so these are big challenges.
I want to give Gerhard a chance, because I know that, you know, Webroot has to make these decisions about what gets on, what you add to your list and what you don't. I was also wondering if you could talk about behavioral, some of the new behavioral things that people are looking at doing at the anti-spyware.
We are facing this decision pretty much every day when we get some new piece of spyware that we have to make a decision. Now, are we going to detect this one? Are we going to block this one? Are we quarantine this one? And we have a pretty well-defined procedure that we have documented that is very transparent, very clear in terms of if it falls in this category, it establishes this behavior, if there is an uninstalled routine, if there is contact points of contact on there, how you can contact the vendor. So it's a pretty methodical way we have developed here, because we need to stay clear as well. We need to be fair at the same time to everybody, treat the good guys and the bad guys pretty much at the same level. So we're pretty much working from a working book here that we have developed that we use as a guideline for our researchers when we make a decision, are we going to add detection for this one or quarantining particular pieces of spyware.
And that's what the ASC risk model was supposed to do. It was supposed to help the companies in this space help make those decisions about what gets on your scorecard or your list that you make you base that on. And that's available on the table, too, for people that want to follow up on that. Yes?
I believe it's at the, again, this is a problem at the legal technical boundaries. What I want is for when these spyware vendors go to their lawyers, say, is it safe to do this? I don't want them to say, well, there's nothing that specifically bans it. This is a different model, but it needs to be this way. You are banned from putting ads on a user's machine unless you are compliant with X, Y, and Z. So there is a particular whitelist, there's a particular path that you can follow to do things that allow you to put these ads up with constraints. It has to be easy to detect where they came from. It needs to be easy to uninstall the software that's causing it. It needs to happen within a certain amount of time. You change it from, well, you can't do that, and you can't do that, to, listen, your entire industry has caused hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. If planes were falling out of the sky, we'd have pretty good regulation. You know what? Planes could fall out of the sky. We do have pretty good regulation. You don't get to fly unless you pass those rules. What I'm saying is you don't get to put ads on machines unless you pass certain rules, because that's the level of damage we're seeing. You know, when it's the number one problem that IT administrators are coming out with, you know, the scale of damage here, this, what was the numbers at one point? 80% of machines had it?
Yeah.
I mean, we can't mess around with this stuff. We need a new model for dealing with spyware.
I want to share the notion. I think there is even further, if you look purely from a technical perspective, I think that the model that we are subscribing today in the whole malware industry, be it antivirus, be it anti-spyware, be it other industries that are targeted to the malware space, the blacklisting model is not going to scale. We are clearly reaching the limit of those technologies now, and I think it's the same case here. We need to start rethinking the whitelisting model as well from this perspective. And the whitelisting model is not something radical new. It has been used for many years, But the challenge is how do you manage your whitelist in a scalable way in an organization, an enterprise there. But I think I subscribe to that thinking pattern as well, that we need to move towards a model where we think about what is good and what is allowed versus what is the bad stuff that we want to keep off the machines.
Yes.
But you also need to have a new policy of looking at how the people are dealt with. When that 21-year-old is out of jail in a couple of years, they're going to be offering him jobs and security. These are job interviews for a lot of these people.
Andre, can you take that one, actually, since...
Oh, joy. Thank you. I saw a friend CSO from Liberty Mutual who started the Razor Group for BindView, and one of the things that, from my perspective, that you always have to evaluate is evaluate not only the talent but the ethical aspects of that as well. I mean, having an entity that potentially can compromise, you know, my organization and leak its intellectual capital and other things like that isn't necessarily a risk that I'm going to take as it relates to hiring an entity just because they have, you know, the skill set there. So I think, you know, there's, although we have seen other organizations, you know, do very, you know, contrary things. But I think, you know, there's a moral question that you have to ask, and, you know, and that question is, do you basically employ an entity that is very talented, knowing the fact that basically you're letting danger into the home, and that in doing so that the organization may be compromised. That's just something that a risk that we're just not going to take. Because a lot of times, you know, out there in the field, I mean, if you think about from an information security program, right, you have three elements, people, process, and technology. In a Spyware case, we're talking about, you know, having inadequate technology to deal with a threat and everything else. But, you know, if I educate my people and I have maybe defined processes and everything else, I can do a better job in combating the spyware menace within my environment versus adopting or, you know, installing new technologies. And so that just goes back to the question, I'm not going to hire an entity that compromises that people element that I mentioned there.
In the back in green. Is Jerry Dixon here actually right now, or you over there? Do you want to take this now, or do you want
to?
Okay. He's with the Department of Homeland Security, and so there actually has been some legislation that has passed over time to try and help companies share information. But let's take it from the FTC's perspective for now, and then we'll let Jerry talk more generally about the rest of the government.
Well, the issue that you really touch on is data security more than spyware, although spyware can compromise the security of data and personally identifiable information. And where the liability can arise on your side or on the part of the private sector is where there is personally identifiable information, sensitive information on the system, and the system operator has failed to take reasonable and appropriate steps to safeguard that personally identifiable information. What constitutes reasonable and appropriate steps really varies from case to case. It's a flexible standard, but that's the standard that the FTC has adopted under our statutory authority, and when we've sued in cases where there have been data breaches, it's been for failure to have in place reasonable and appropriate measures to safeguard data. If you're thinking about getting in touch with us to report a spyware problem or a hacking problem or something that's happened, and you've got reasonable and appropriate measures in place, then you shouldn't have a problem. You shouldn't be afraid to get in touch with us. If you've had a data breach and you didn't have those kinds of procedures in place, you may wind up on the other end of an enforcement action, but it would still be, we're likely to find out about it anyway. So you might as well let us know. And we'll work out the terms of the order, but, we could also, and you may mitigate in some way the nature of the remedies sought. No promises.
We've had some companies come to us, to CDT, and we've kind of been a middleman. We've served as a middleman in some cases where we've independently researched the same things that the companies have been finding and been able to, and given that information over to the FTC and others as completely independent research that we've done just using the same set of research. That's another way of going about it.
I enjoy the comment and the feedback, though. I mean, it's interesting in the sense that I, as an organization, potentially, go to the FTC, whomever, and I want to ensure that my organization's privacy is safeguarded and everything, but maybe I'm not as diligent as I should have been. And now, so you flip the angle around a little bit. Instead of helping me solve what my problem is now I face prosecution and other things like that. And so, I mean, I don't necessarily think that model works well.
Well, we are not here to help you solve your problem. We're here to enforce the law, and we're here to understand what's going on in the marketplace that may violate the law. So the FTC does not exist to help individual consumers solve their problems or, network operators to solve their problems. We exist to enforce the Federal Trade Commission's prohibition on deceptive and unfair practices.
I'll also say that I know for a fact, because I've been CC'd on some of these, that the FTC gets quite a lot of anonymous tips as well for people out there. You want to follow up on that? Or?
I'd like to follow up on that.
There does seem to be a fairly inexorable push towards centralized analysis of vulnerability data. From what goes back to Microsoft through their online crash analysis to what goes around just random, like all the antivirus software, or much of it is starting to go ahead and put things back. Gerard, I'm sure your software does reporting back to what it's finding. If you don't have that, you're right. You don't get a global view. I mean, the definitive quote is you can't manage what you can't measure. And without global measurement, there's no global management. I do agree, though. It does seem to be problematic if by participating in this system that is making the Internet more secure, you're opening yourself up to point source risk. That's a problem. I mean, that's something that your lawyers can just be like, you know what? It becomes almost like a tragedy of the commons. This may be a good thing for everyone, but if we can get prosecution over a particular thing that is in this data, we have we shouldn't give it out.
And we probably have a little bit of an unfair advantage here because this is part of our business, finding those pieces of new malware, and we are working with the authorities pretty much on an ongoing basis. If we find something new, no problem from our end to work with them because there's nothing on our end. It's usually something that we get reported from the outside or find through our research system anyway. So we're very open about that, and we have actually a very good relationship with those folks in terms of getting it shut down if needed.
Even the person in the back there has had his hand.
Yeah, I heard the 80% figure quoted a little while back. When you go to the reputable end of the anti-spyware markets and take their test tools and run them, it comes up and says no infected file found, no infected machine found, one found, 35 cookies, you are infected with spyware. So the question for the panel is, do you consider cookies and the presence of cookies as spyware? And if not, do you consider this
I'll start by saying that tracking cookies do show up in the Anti-Spyware Coalition definition of spyware, but I'll just say point people to that definition. Maybe Gary.
By design, my slides excluded cookies today.
I agree. Cookies are probably the single most overrated security threat that we've seen in the last 10 years. That being said, it is worth recognizing that web applications are a different application sphere than what is on the desktop, and that certain uses of cookies, especially if you have an individual site that you go to that gets personally identifiable information, and then that personally identifiable information is retransmitted to every other site you go that has a tracking cookie. You know what? I have a hard time, honestly, not calling that. And I'm one of the stronger people who hate calling cookies a security threat. Even I got to admit, if I can go to a random site and it can tell me exactly who I am because 4 months ago I went to some other site and I told it, okay, that's a problem.
And that's pretty much the definition of tracking cookie in the Anti-Spyware Coalition definitions. Let's see if we can get one more question in. Last question.
There's a lot of discussion about the legal limitations for prosecution. So what is on the horizon to try to change that, to strengthen the laws to make it easier? Are we seeing that trend on national or on a state-by-state basis?
I'm probably the best person to answer this on the panel. So national, state-by-state, we've seen a number of laws pass. In fact, Louisiana just passed another one, so I don't know what the... And I think there are a couple more under consideration, so I don't know what their total current number is at the states. Most of those state laws don't really go beyond what's already illegal in most under current consumer protection law in the states, but some of them do raise the penalties in the states. And so you have seen some cases brought under the spyware law, most notably... and again, this is in the full enforcement cases there, if you want to look at the state laws. Texas's attorney general has brought a case under their spyware law against Sony, and is continuing that lawsuit, although the other ones are settled. So that's an interesting one that's out there. On the state, on the federal level, there are a number of bills that are out there that do different things. The House has passed two bills, actually. One that would require notice for ads and the type of ads that you see from software and certain types of tracking and would raise the penalties and give the FTC civil enforcement penalties, which is that they could get more than just the ill-gotten gains. They can get actual amount of the actual amount that the bad guys made off of. Beyond that, they get an actual number. Fine, like $11,000 per incident kind of thing. And then Senate bill, which is similar to that, has passed out of committee, but is probably not going to the floor this year. And since it's going to be the end of the Congress, you're unlikely to see the two come together, although it's still a small possibility. But it will probably have to start all over from scratch next year, unless something can be worked out between the House version and the Senate version. And then also the other House bill is a criminal bill that would criminalize... A lot of this is already criminal under Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Thank you. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and so this adds on a couple new pieces to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Well, I want to thank the panel. Does anyone have any last comments? I want to thank the panel, and we're going to break, and then we'll come back and talk about the future, where things are going, etc. Thank you. Well, we're going to start up again. I'm sure that people will be coming in as we go along here, but I wanted to make sure that we have a larger panel and make sure that everyone has time to give their points and we can get an active discussion like we did in the last session. The first speaker that we're going to have is John Heisman, who's a consultant at the principal security consultant at NGS. John.
Good afternoon, everybody.
One second. Just as a reminder, I'm not giving everyone's bios out again. They're in your books, so I'm just going to announce who the person is, and you can look up the bio. Thank you, John.
So the first point on my notes here, I was going to talk about increasing rootkit-like technology in spyware. But actually, before I talk about that, I want to go through the process from getting spyware onto a user's machine all the way through to how it actually might communicate that data. So if we think about current delivery mechanisms for spyware onto a user's system, typically browser exploits, bugs in file format bugs, so like the recent spate of vulnerabilities in Microsoft Office products, they're being used to deploy spyware. Peer-to-peer software, IM networks. So I think all of these delivery mechanisms will continue in the future. File format vulnerabilities certainly show no signs of abating, so maybe browsers will become more locked down, but file format vulnerabilities in various pieces of software commonly found on user systems, so media players, that type of thing, will continue as a mechanism of delivery. We may actually see some kind of two-stage deployment mechanism of spyware in the future because of technologies like least user access, so Lua coming out on Vista, and various identity management solutions that try and restrict access to personal user data. So we may actually see the initial deployment where through a vulnerability in the browser software, the spyware application starts running. It then actually invokes a second exploit to try and escalate privilege, so it's then able to access the information it wants, so escalate from a low user privilege to admin. And once it's attained admin privileges, it can then hook system-wide, and it can install a kernel component, hence the rootkit-like technologies. So the rootkit-like technologies will see anything currently done in user mode, so things like layered service providers, WinSock LSPs for hooking network traffic, well, we might start to see that rather at a kernel level. And this is essentially going to have to raise the bar for spyware detection software, because if you have spyware that has kernel components, essentially, this means you're going to need spyware. You're going to need spyware detection software that also has a kernel component. So you're not going to be able to detect a kernel component from user mode with much success. The next point I want to make is kind of emphasizing something that Dan made in the first session, which is essentially any spyware on your system makes your system less secure. And this is for two reasons. Firstly, the spyware might install something, a component that is designed to help it update and stay alive on that system. So as Dan suggested, an ActiveX control that has a method that will allow you to remotely run any executable. But also, the quality of spyware itself. Spyware is typically poorly written. There are security vulnerabilities in spyware, so buffer overflows, etc. And the Sony rootkit is a good example. Essentially, they developed a system that enabled them to hide processes and files by hooking various functions in the kernel. But that could be abused so that by simply renaming an executable, you could take advantage of that functionality in the kernel and hide your own processes. So instantly, that made the machine less secure, because malware that was simply running in user mode could make use of that and hide itself by simply calling itself $sys.foobar.exe. So it's a concern that if spyware moves into the kernel, that's going to make your system even wider open. I guess in the future, again, in the first session, Dan mentioned using DNS to see what your machine is actually, where it's sending information. So in the future, we may expect to see better or harder to detect channels out of the spyware software. So better, essentially, covert channels. And the final point I want to make is that we may actually see spyware that attempts to detect when the user's running spyware detection software and attempts to subvert that software. So if it's running in kernel, hooks a function that starts a new process, and then the spyware has a list of known detection software that it wants to block running. So I guess really, to conclude, I would say that the more rootkit-like technology we see, the harder it's going to be to remove, the harder it's going to be to detect, and really this is going to have to result in manufacturers of spyware detection software really raising the bar in the way they detect. So that's it.
Thanks, Sean. A lot to think about there. Ron Davidson is next. He's the CTO of MI5 Networks.
So I will say a sentence or two about my background because I think it's a little different and that's my perspective on some of these issues. I did spend most of my previous career, over 25 years, with an intelligence community, a foreign intelligence community, the Israeli one, doing all sorts of high-tech spy wars. Some people would call these spy wars, but on both sides of the of this front. So most of my experience come from say national security point of view, but I think things I see how things directly relate to corporate spyware, which is where we started this panel, and the future of spyware. First, just regarding the numbers that we saw in the previous session, we do not see 80% of the end users infected. I don't see how people are able to detect so many infected PCs, as we call them, unless they really count every third party cookie or something like that. We do see some decline. I think I agree with what was presented here in the adware, and I think in general in the future the place of adware is going to be shrinking, and the place of the much more severe stuff. In that sense, it's going to be more about the quality of spyware, and not just the quantity, not how many machines. So even if you take the corporate point of view, it doesn't really matter how many machines are infected with a keylogger. If just a couple of machines, but strategically placed keyloggers are there, then the problem is much more critical than if 70 or 40 or whatever number of machines are infected with adware. In general, I don't see huge developments on the technology side, and personally I'm not very much concerned with yet another generation of rootkit technology. There will be additional tools to detect those. There will be virtual machine rootkits, and there will be virtual machines that users are running to avoid the rootkits and so on. So this technology war will continue. I think that the main complexities of the future are going to be in more maybe on the operational side of things, and who is behind spyware and how complex is the spyware operation. Once again, I'm talking mainly about corporate spyware, not just adware. And there will be additional ways to get into the corporate network and additional ways to get out of it, and there will be a hybrid of ways. We already see some of these things when you go in through the mail chain, you go out through the HTTP, and we will see all the possible combinations of getting in through some Wi-Fi or Bluetooth access and getting out through some covert Skype or other VoIP session and so on. So, and some of these issues are technology, so you need to excel on that front, but some of these issues are really to come up with the infrastructure to support, from the operational point of view, a large-scale corporate spyware operation. So you need to understand the network that you're attacking. You need to find different ways to go in and out. You need to find ways to expand and your presence inside the corporate network once you're there, and to find the interesting stuff in there and not just randomly attack one or machine that is maybe more vulnerable than the other. And I think with this who is behind spyware? So of course the previous session was mainly about adware and adware companies. It's not that I like adware, but I think that this is really the place where maybe the regulators, the prosecutors and legislation and so on can do more of that. But all these are completely irrelevant when we are talking about more critical spyware, the criminal type of things. And we know and we see that organized crime is already involved in spyware, especially in spam. There were several cases where there were full-blown war between anti-spam and the spam mafia out there. And so far, at least in the previous rounds, the spam mafia won, and not necessarily the good guys. I can certainly see how many more organizations and individuals like those are coming into the picture, bringing in more resources, more operational capabilities. This is becoming a global war, not something that is can be handled locally or within the United States and so on. And the global cooperation between the bad guys is at least as good as the global cooperation between the good guys. I think in particular it means that some of the avenues, some of the ways that we need to make a significant progress in is the cooperation between all the parties involved. I heard the keynote speaker this morning from the FBI, but I think it's also more cooperation between the industry, within the industry, not necessarily just the industry players and the government, more cooperation between ISPs and security vendors, between security vendors, more hybrid, say, or multi-level defense products or strategies that combine the offerings or the advantages of different security approaches. I think I could see some similarities in the way the crimeware or the critical spyware is going and the global crime and even terror. I can talk a little bit more about this maybe later, but in any case, we are going to the point where the legislation is irrelevant, the regulation is irrelevant. We'll have to fight it and win it through cooperation, through global cooperation, and through better defense, and maybe sometimes even some attack.
Thanks. Next on the list is Drew Manis from Walt Disney.
Thank you, Ari. From an enterprise standpoint, the threat of spyware, I totally agree that adware is going to be on the decline, but there's still work that we need to be needs to be done in that area. Policies around making sure you know where your ad dollars are going, education of your own users, and also there's the delivery of content to your customers and protecting that. You know, the past 10 years, it's always been about protecting the inbound traffic into your environment. Now we have to start thinking of, well, we're allowing a trusted vendor to shovel code to our customers. We do have some responsibility there to make sure that code is clean and not malicious. then also from the internal side, I think there's going to be more of the need to understand exactly what is going on the network. When you get into a large global corporate environment, that becomes challenging to know exactly what is being connected and what's not. But I think that the tools will come. But on the other side of it, though, is when you look at the desktop and protecting the desktop and the deperimeterization of the network, we can't keep putting another client for every threat that comes out. It's sooner or later the CFO is just going to say enough is enough. You can't, you know, you got your antivirus, you have your anti-spy, you have whatever the next threat is. And all of those also introduce vulnerabilities into the environment, right? I'm well familiar with the Witty worm from a couple years back. So I think the future is understanding what's going on in the network, developing better tools to determine what is on there, and also having a forensic capability that I don't think you necessarily have today. Your help desk is going to have to understand that it is spyware. If it is spyware, now you've got to look at your legal obligations on breach disclosure. You can't just treat it like a normal virus. So I think that in the future we'll be seeing more of that as well.
Thanks. We'll get deeper into those those issues that you raised there, I'm sure, in the question and answer session. And last, we have Jerry Dixon from the Department of Homeland Security. Jerry.
So back to Ari's earlier comment about centralizing the internet, centralized control. I think we'd go a long ways to solving these problems. Is it what I heard earlier? Or? So in all seriousness, I think what Drew just touched on. One of our concerns is the sheer number of products to combat, a multitude of problems. There is some convergence, with your antivirus and spyware-type technologies, and I think Ron highlighted a key point that I wanted to emphasize, and this is something that's been real effective with phishing, is, the sharing of these, the repositories of the different samples of spyware, the sharing of the databases across the vendors, not playing the game of, I've got more signatures than your company does, or getting into that kind of aspect. One of the things that we've done, just even in the phishing space, is working with law enforcement and some, the anti-phishing working group, some other organizations. We receive hundreds of phishing reports daily. Every 24 hours, we actually provide a data feed into some of these organizations that, in turn, push those lists out to all the commercial vendors. From our perspective, from a U.S. CERT perspective, it's going to get the most widest protection, the most expedient way to get protection out to folks and help mitigate or minimize some of this. Back to the issue, I know Dan raised, I don't know if Dan's still in here, but, some of the things that we're seeing, it's nice to look at your DNS logs, but we're also seeing host files being modified. We're seeing the use of dynamic DNS with short time to lives. I mean, it's not just a single, there's not a magic bullet for this problem. So, that's really where you got to, be cooperating with everybody to, at least within the vendor space, to really help combat these issues. How many of you have AutoRun set up on your machine now? Is it, or how many of you disabled it? Nobody? Okay. So, one of the things, I saw a study I was reading the other day where, somebody was doing a penetration test with a credit union, and basically they just put out USB flash drives all over the place, just left them sitting on desks, no message, no nothing. Most of the machine, pretty much all the machines had auto run enabled, and what it did is half of them, out of curiosity, plugged it right in. Boom, loaded up, a keylogger, beaconed home, in this test case, it was a controlled environment, and basically, they had a high amount of users. It's always about the users, right? They had a large number of users, just, again, plugging it in. So little things like that. I mean, this is a multifaceted problem that we got to deal with. One of the things that we're seeing from a trends perspective is the very specific targeting against specific organizations. Whether it's looking at proprietary information for some of the commercial companies that we've worked with. We're seeing directed, emails with, the friendly attachment or, kind of the phishing deal, but again, at a very targeted core group of folks that they're, wishing to gain information from. So that's one of the increases of some of the things and activities that we're seeing from our perspective. Another issue is a lot of popular websites. We've worked with a lot of companies where we helped them clean up the spyware, give them the advice, and within minutes of them bringing the server back online, get popped again. User has no user interaction, just by browsing to the site, get some goodies installed onto the machine. So, again, you know, it's a widespread problem. You know, I used to, you know, say, you know, we can, you know, security awareness will go a long way, which it still will, but now it's to the point where the user doesn't actually have to take any specific action. The last piece I want to cover is the whole issue of Sony. I know, at least from a federal government perspective, there's actually 5 criminal cases opened up really quickly. You know, basically, it was being considered a 1030 violation or an intrusion, you know, unauthorized access into a government computing system. Got a lot of people spun up. Sony got a really rude awakening. I know our folks, Stuart Baker, is, and I believe he's working with FTC as well, which is our policy person for Secretary Chertoff. But these are some of the types of issues and things that we're combating. Again, you know, no user consent. And then in some cases, as you all know, you know, a lot of times if there is a user consent, it's buried into that, you know, 20-page, you know, small print, you know, click-through. So there's a lot of challenges from a policy perspective. But, you know, again, key trends that we're seeing, seeing very targeted type attacks. We're seeing the multiple methods being used to phone home and pull down additional goodies. You know, again, kind of a round, you know, round-robin dynamic DNS. You know, 1 minute it might communicate with a specific address to bring in additional goodies, and within seconds later or, you know, hours later, it'll phone home to a different box. They're very creative. So I think we're going to continue to see a lot of challenges in this space. I think one of the big solutions or things that really needs to be addressed is how do we get the vendors together, at least share, you know, that common set of information so we can get the information out there. You know, I see heads shaking, but I know, you know, at least within the phishing space, it's gone a long ways, you know, in helping that out. And it also helps prioritize when we talk about prosecution and going after folks. You know, law enforcement has a limited set of resources. What those type of efforts do is, you know, when you look at NCFTA or what was talked about at the keynote today, some of the other efforts, is that they actually help prioritize, you know, what are the big fish, what are the top 10, top 15, you know, we're going to go after those, take care of those. When they're successful with those, they'll go ahead and move to the next top 10 or 15. But as that data comes in, you know, it at least helps prioritize to knock out some of the bigger players and then just keep whittling away at it. Unfortunately, I think it's one of the most effective mechanisms that we have today.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Just to follow up on that, the Anti-Spyware Coalition is actually, we've just built a system to share information. It's starting to be used right now. So it is kind of, we're testing it out, and we're going to see how it works internally and people that are interested in that piece of it. And we will be talking to DHS about it in the future, I know for a fact. So just to follow up on that main point that you made. There's a lot of different ways to go here. I think one question that was not addressed that I'd like to hear each person in turn's answer in it is what do people think about the distribution of WinCare and Windows Defender and how that's going to change the marketplace for spyware and the different issues involved in security as it relates to spyware in particular.
We can go in a reverse order if you want to go last this time.
Sure.
Why don't we start with you, Jerry?
Sure, put me on the spot. Actually, I should put Jerry Cochran on the spot since he's here from Microsoft. But basically, you know, I think it's making progress. You know, I think, again, you know, working with, and again, it goes back to the way some of these are doing. I know at least with the Microsoft solution, there's some more registry real-time monitoring, some capabilities there that are interesting. You know, I haven't actually done a product comparison, but I think anything that helps tackle this issue and tackles this problem is going to help, you know, protect the consumer. So, you know, I don't know what the haven't looked at any, you know, recent studies on rollout of Windows, you know, WinCare and seeing what the density of folks that have jumped onto that bandwagon, but I think it's, you know, anything out there to combat the problem is a positive. But again, it goes back to my earlier comment. You really do have to have some level of cooperation across those product sets. They can still tackle the problem from different perspective, but I think based on the identified spyware artifacts, you know, you kind of need to share that information to make sure everybody's pretty well covered.
Yeah, I mean, when we start building it into the operating system or adding it to the operating system, I think that goes a long way towards protection. Yeah, I, too, have not really looked at WinCare, so I'm not going to go too far. But I think that's a welcomed solution. So.
And also without looking too deeply into it, I'm a little skeptic. I think the good guys are getting. The good guys are getting smarter, the bad guys are getting smarter, at least as fast as the good guys, and it's going to get worse before it gets much better, if it gets much better anytime. So I think that anybody who can add a layer, I think in general a multi-layer defense is the strategy to go for the corporate. So if one part on the desktop is improved and some other parts on the desktop are improved and the gateway parts are improved and hopefully the ISP and the overall national infrastructure is better, then and we all cooperate, then we'll provide some better service to our customers. But the problem is not going to get away, especially not just by Microsoft.
Yeah, I basically agree with the points just made. Essentially, anything that keeps a machine more fully patched is obviously a good thing. But I think this will mean that we may see deployment via other common non-Microsoft applications. So, for example, if you have your system being patched as soon as a Windows patch comes out, Then exploitation of browser, i.e. flaws in IE, may go down, but then you may see a rise in exploitation via other flaws, other means, so other software that's commonly bundled with Windows. And invariably, spyware will evolve to attempt to subvert the Windows Defender and OneCare. So I'm sure there will be some attacks that attempt to stop it working, to block it in some way, to circumvent it.
Anyone else want to cover the future of distribution methods? I mean, I think Ron, you raised the point about keystroke loggers. How do you see them being distributed? I mean, we've seen some of these scams where there was a guy in London who had basically sent fake proposals, and the secretaries would click on them and get his home-built keylogger on their machines and use it. He would use that as a launching point. Is there any other kind of ideas about how we're going to see some of that spread in the future?
I really do think file format bugs are going to continue to be the main method of deployment, but there are many means of actually getting those particular file formats onto the system in question. So, for example, we've all seen attempts to get malware onto a system via email, where somebody sends you something saying, open this. And maybe it's some sort of graphic which contains a bug, for example, WMF. But as Ron said, there are many, many new ways of your machine interacting, Bluetooth, etc. So there are many potential means for actually getting the infected file onto the target system. But as I see it, I really do believe that file format bugs will continue to be a major problem.
Well, I guess the variety of way that any piece of information gets into the desktop, the keyloggers will get there as well. Fine social engineering, not just social engineering, but well tuned into the specific recipients is one way, and then all of the technological ways to get there as well. Well, even this guy and Chetta that we talked about him, if he got paid a little bit more by a keylogger, publisher, then he would install these instead of adware. So it's as long as something is installed, keyloggers and the most malicious stuff is installed, then there will always be a way in. The fact that the system is getting more complex doesn't mean that it's just becoming more robust. It's also becoming more vulnerable in other ways, and it's just a process that we fine-tune all the time, but we open back those knowingly or unknowingly just as much.
Just out of curiosity, I'm going to kind of flip the question around a little bit. How many of you utilize like a Tivoli or an SMS or a desktop management solution to actually, I know previous places where I've worked, we've actually created a list to actually go out, scan the drives and actually clean, you know, your desktop PCs across your enterprise. Just curious, you know, how many actually leverage that as a tool kind of to combat this problem? Okay. Again, just, you know, kind of a, you know, I know we didn't really go into a lot of, you know, we talked about multi-layered defenses, but there's a lot of tools at our disposal. You know, again, it's just like anything. It's, you know, whack-a-mole. But at least it seems to be, you know, when you've got a large enterprise of 130,000 plus desktops or more, I mean, those seem to be, you know, some effective tools that folks can leverage to help with eradicating the spyware. You know, your content filtering solutions at the gateway. I mean, there's just a lot of options out there. It's just like anything, you know, it's good to say, you know, yeah, I've got firewalls, I've got security infrastructure, but it's back to, are you really managing it? Are you actually watching it and doing due diligence there? So just kind of wanted to touch on that. One, I had actually a question for Ari that you might have from a legal perspective. You know, what are, you know, and I've seen, you know, articles in the past and discussions, you know, things being mislabeled as spyware, you know, so what are some of the ramifications and what are some of the things that, you know, I don't know if y'all keep track of some of those issues, but I do know from a liability perspective, it seems kind of an interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason that the Anti-Spyware Coalition basically formed, was to come up with, and did, the reason that we did our vendor dispute process. To try and make sure that there was an industry-wide process for when people felt that they were being mislabeled, they could go through a step-by-step process and that could be addressed directly. Now, I think that there have been some clear cases where mistakes have been made, but I think if you look at the total number of people that are complaining out there and the people that where mistakes are made, the number of false positives has been relatively good from what I've seen in the industry. I don't know if people in here have other viewpoints on that, but I think that they have gone through and done a good job. There is the threat hanging over that if you do a bad job, you can be sued for tortious interference, et cetera. There has been a push for to give the anti-spyware companies immunity in law if they follow some kind of basic process that has some kind of arbiter, et cetera, from making mistakes. And I think that you would see anti-spyware companies be much more aggressive at stopping new threats and be willing to put things up much faster if they had that kind of immunity. And it's something that we may need to explore if this problem gets much worse. Yes?
One of the things that concerns me the most is you keep dropping desktop, but, you know, we have VoIP, and, you know, the VoIP phones are basically computers. We have the iPods, we have cell phones, and what really scares me the most are industrial control systems, where a tremendous amount of intellectual property of this country's, you know, manufacturing industry and utility resides within industrial control systems. But I don't hear anything about, you know, the being concerned about spyware or monitoring or, you know, illicit activity on anything other than traditional desktops.
Well, I do think that the question is sort of, where are we going to see spyware next? I mean, how do we see it, and what are we going to do about it? Yeah.
Sure, I think that is a concern, and that's also a valid point, that currently we might not be seeing spyware on mobile devices, for example, because there's so much easy picking, so many desktops, it's so easy to get onto the desktops. But sure, I fully believe that we will start to see spyware for mobile platforms, for example, and the industry will have to respond. We'll expect to see spyware removal tools for mobile platforms.
Anywhere.
Well, I'd certainly agree that the VoIP phones are a potential threat just as much as any other piece that is hooked to the network, and the fact that there's no maybe sensitive information residing within that phone doesn't mean that it cannot be a platform to attack the rest of the network if it's vulnerable. So in that point, from that point of view, it's something that you need to be concerned with. From my perspective, one of the ways to go around is really to tell the gateway or the network point of view and not necessarily of each of the endpoints, whether the endpoint is a Windows machine, a VoIP phone, or even a router that runs some operating system and software and has its own vulnerabilities and so on. And some of the corporate guys here and in the previous panel also expressed the concern that you cannot really deal with 50,000 end users in your network. So you cannot install many more clients. You cannot really handle that very efficiently. So you need additional layers that will take a global look at the network and not just try to deal with the every endpoint.
Jerry, can you address the critical infrastructure question too?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, it comes back down to the question of motive. You know, a lot of times when you got the, you know, electronic crimes with the money aspects, you know, for profit, when you start getting into, you know, back to the low-hanging fruit right now, you know, when I think back of, you know, red teaming or pen testing, that kind of work, you know, there really hasn't been a network I haven't been able to get into. So, I mean, when you've got so much, why make it harder on yourself when you've got all that low-hanging fruit? As security, you know, and organizations raise the bar from security, it's going, you know, you know, things will probably start moving down that that path. We've just not seen a lot of widespread activity with those type of sophisticated issues. But back to my example with the USB drives and CDs and things of that nature, I mean, there's a lot of fun things you can do there. You know, again, back to some as simple as the auto run or visiting a website. What's really concerning to us is that some of these websites are, you know, specifically targeted with, you know, spyware and the vehicle to deliver other payloads, but basically because they kind of know the typical audience that would go visit that website. So, I mean, that's kind of, you know, the main trend that we're seeing today. Some of our issues is going back in and, you know, trying to get these organizations, help them clean it up. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're not your paid security consultant. You know, we always recommend that they go out and get somebody to help them with that. We'll provide some basic guidance. But, you know, we continually see some of these organizations get popped again and again and again. So it's a never-ending thing. And what's always interesting is we get, you know, they'll come back and want a good housekeeping seal from US CERT saying our network is safe. Can you send out a message or an advisory saying, you know, our website's safe, you know, we're, you know, it's out of our control. But, again, back to low-hanging fruit, control systems. You know, there's a, you know, when you talk about, the spyware and some of the application things that are used there, you know, like ICCP, some of the protocols and stuff. I mean, that's really not really seen spyware kind of take off into that environment yet. We've seen other fun and creative things take place from, you know, denial of service type issues, buffer overflows, and those types of things, but nothing really as it relates to spyware yet. Yes.
So, as a content provider, I don't really concern myself with desktop as much as the content that I provide. And, for instance, recently we had the MySpace issue where they had a cross-site scripting vulnerability that distributed out like spyware that had nothing to do with MySpace but some other company used. Do you see this as something that we're going to see more of, and what can we do about that?
That's a perfect question for Drew, I think, isn't it?
Ha, no.
Well, Raymond is setting me up because he works with our internet group, so... No. I mean, it is. It's absolutely something that we have to look at, right? As I said earlier, we were so interested in protecting the perimeter from inbound traffic that we do owe it to our customers to protect them and developing that and what that looks like. You know, our internet infrastructure is you can't just slap an IPS out in front of that. You're going to have code on there that looks at it, some sort of way of identifying what is appropriate to be handing to the users and not maybe trusting some of the vendors as blatantly as we have.
My organization, CDT, has done some reports on mainstream advertisers advertising with some of the worst adware players, Zango and Direct Revenue, and try to out some of the people who's names show up there, and I think that there's a tie between both advertising and distribution. I mean, Warner Brothers also this week had a deal with Zango that they've now backed away from that was distributing Zango basically on a kid's site, on a cartoon site. And it said, you know, you may get firearms and pornography may be displayed through these ads, and the box was pre-checked. And it was aimed at, you know, it was clearly aimed at people looking for a Fred Flintstone game and cartoon games. So we have seen distribution channels, you know, high quality distribution channels become infiltrated in ways that are somewhat surprising. Yes?
So the one area that we look at is the trustee certification. It's started around the online privacy, but they also started, I think they're beta testing the trustee download. I don't know if there's anyone from that organization here. But they seem to be trying to do the same, that exact same thing, right? So certifying whether your partners down the chain, because it does get, you know, as some of Ari's previous presentations, that infrastructure, especially with adware, gets very confusing, and so it's not always easy to know that if I sign up here that it's not going to end up at some funding some adware down 10, 12 steps down the line.
That's the only initiative that I know of.
That's the
it's
I
a trustee
of, yeah.
Trusted download program for people that are in that space of the content program to look into. There are some other blacklist kind of ideas out there. Stop Badware, which is a program that's run out of Harvard, and a lot of large companies like Google and others have been funding, has been looking into that, kind of the blacklist area more than the whitelist area. But the only true whitelist has been trustee, and it's actually an alpha right now.
Is it alpha?
I think they're moving to beta in September or October, something like that. But
there were some email initiatives for trusted mail to fight spam, but I don't think these are really scalable. So I'm not sure the concept in general is scalable.
Yes.
Yeah. Given all the activity that's been going on, you know, as far as a lot of the software providers like McAfee and Norton and Microsoft, and providing these tools and technologies, either there's the operations layer or the app layer, you know, to really detect and eradicate, you know, spyware activity. What I'm more concerned about is how do we prevent this from occurring in ongoing and into the future? And I see this as a problem that we're being managed by. One of the things that comes to mind is, you know, a lot of the activity that was being done around host-based intrusion prevention software. And what I'm wondering is, you know, what can you tell me about, you know, the ongoing role of host-based intrusion prevention technologies that really look at a behavior-based solution rather than a signature-based solution?
So in Vista, you have the concept of least user access. So one of the real problems, one of the real reasons why spyware is so widespread is because so many users run on their systems with elevated privilege. So as soon as you have a flaw in the browser, the spyware can take advantage of that and essentially install whatever it wants with no hassle. So the concept in Vista is that you run by default as a low privileged user. So sure, there'll still be bugs, browser bugs, for example, but that will actually prevent the installation of any software. So that's one thing I can think of off the top of my head. Essentially, any kind of sandboxing technology, that would certainly help.
I was just about to say that, yeah. I'm not in a great position to list all them because I'll leave someone out and then I'll upset someone on our coalition. But Sana Security is an example of one of them. If anyone have any others that they want to name, throw out there.
But I mean, also part of the problem with that is especially with spyware, is with the behavioral-based HIPs, spyware isn't necessarily a vulnerability at certain points, right? If the user actually installs it, HIPS isn't going to solve that problem. Right, but
Right, but even with Sana, you have to break outside of the trusted path, right? So they baseline your system, and then all of a sudden you have to... Oh. Okay.
That's right. That's my understanding, too.
All right.
So I do think we're starting to see more of those solutions out there, whether they've actually grown up enough to start penetrating the marketplace in ways that they need to make a huge difference. I don't think we've seen that yet, but it's I think it's a growing trend. Yes?
Exactly. Right. But really only slightly. I mean, let's be honest. Our users are going to hit yes. I mean, in a creative environment like the Walt Disney Company, it's very difficult to lock down people that way. We had a group that decided that the 15-minute lockout timeout wasn't appropriate, and they developed a mouse that would vibrate about 14 and a half minutes. To get around it, so it'd be nice to lock them down, but yeah, sometimes we have to work around that too.
And what do you do with those groups that you know keep coming back to you asking you for certain things to be installed constantly, etc.? How do you handle it internally? I'm sure a lot of people deal with this.
Yeah, you have to allow it in some cases, and you just try to provide enough protection either on the network itself or on the system that to help. Stop it, but especially with laptop users in a remote global environment, it's very difficult not to right now give them administrative privileges because at some point they're going to be out there and they're going to need to install something.
And what about training? I mean, in terms of in terms
of security awareness, we make everyone go through that.
And spyware is a how do you go about doing
it? It's malicious code.
Yeah,
I don't know that we necessarily call out spyware in the training, but it's a good point.
Yes, right there.
So I'm curious if the panel has opinions on we don't really see technology solving all the problems. There's other issues like policy and stuff. So from an R&D agenda point of view, maybe this, the DTC, you guys have an R&D agenda you're pushing or from the federal government. What should be the R&D agenda priorities for addressing spyware on technologies or enhancements in
sure, go ahead.
One of the things that I wanted to bring up as well is we think about this problem serially, and we're always tackling today's problem.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of guys in DOD, CIA, DHS that have red cell experience. We should be looking at this problem and taking a herding mentality, which is where do we want to push these bad actors to so that we can control them rather than vice versa. So from an R&D perspective, let's herd these right. We've got a lot of right people. Let's get them together in the right forum for business, technology, government, military, and figure this problem out in a series of steps. Where do we want to push? Where do we want to push these people in a space where we can control it?
Jared, do you want to add anything to that? I mean, I think it was a point as much as a question, a good one. But
well, right now, from a research perspective, we work very closely with science and technology We've got we push in, you know, things that we're seeing as issues. You know, right now, I mean, there, you know, there's issues, you know, related to DNS amplification attacks, that kind of stuff. You know, what is a long-term solution? You know, of course, you know, we do look at the short-term because we got a lot of people that are bleeding, you know, from those types of attacks. So we got to address that. But we are working to, you know, feed in requirements, and then they get prioritized. As far as working with industry, I mean, we do this with a lot of the internet service providers and major telcos on tackling issues, you know, back to botnets and some of those types of things. And, you know, I do know that there's, I think FTC mentioned that they've got a couple of efforts where they are bringing, you know, other federal agencies together as well as the private sector to kind of work through some of these issues. So I think there is a willingness to do research and put out, you know, kind of an RFI, you know, to the academia, you know, what are some of the potential areas to help tackle some of these long term?
Eileen mentioned this briefly, but there's a workshop in November that they're holding. It's on consumer protection generally, so it's more on in the consumer space. But where they're going to bring together, they're trying to bring exactly these groups that you mentioned together, and then what Jerry was talking about. They're also planning on having all of the international law enforcement, they're all other international law enforcement partners together for a day for a closed session just for them to try and figure out how to work together internationally, since so much of this touches on international servers, et cetera, and that's kind of looking at that issue in the future. But I do think that if you have ideas about, you know, getting ahead of the game, that is a good place to raise it, and the DHS people and the DOJ people are going to be at those sessions as well as it's a good idea. It's also a good idea to have DHS sponsor something like that as well on those kind of issues.
And actually, you know, Mark is over here. He's actually working with Science and Technology. Might be able to speak to some of.
Just briefly, I'm Mark Stocks. I'm not employed by DHS, but I work for SRI International. I used to be at DHS and supporting science and technology. And yes, we do have exactly what you're talking about. One thing to highlight is a group we call the IT Technology Council, ITTC.
One of the things that we've seen on our side from doing the forensic work to try and bring some of these cases to the FTC and state AG's attention is that, you know, it takes us a month or two to investigate it. Then it takes them 10 months to bring a case. I mean, in the Sanford Walls case, which is a case that we thought we really laid out for them on a silver platter, it took them 10 months to bring the case to fruition where they actually shut the guy down. You know, he didn't end up being punished for over a year past that. And in more complicated cases, as Eileen was saying earlier, where you're talking about seven or eight partners involved, it's even harder than that. And I guess the question of really helping in terms of forensics, how do we get, you know, I think CERT has made a lot of, has done a lot of positive work on the virus side, doing active forensic work and group forensic work in that area. How do we get that same kind of forensic work for spyware and malware? You know, Jerry, Ron, I don't know if anybody.
Yeah, you know.
Jerry's volunteering.
I mean, there's obviously no shortage of work in this space. And, you know, I think, you know, there's some existing models that can be leveraged to help out. I know, you know, just even on the phishing stuff, you know, we put out a section on the USCERT.gov website, report phishing here, and, you know, my team about killed me the next day because we just got hammered. You know, the volume is very high. That's why we went and partnered with these organizations, these not-for-profits, to actually take that information, triage it, you know, is it the same, you know, same person that's originating the phish or what have you, and then getting it into, you know, to the folks either prioritize it for law enforcement as well as getting it into commercial products. And I think the same similar type of activity is going to kind of have to, you know, I think the anti-spyware effort is going to have to move in that direction as well to be effective.
So this chain of questions started with the R&D. So while I did say in the beginning that I don't think technology is the main, is the only, certainly not the only way to solve the problem, we are of course involved in several efforts. One of them goes to, back to the behavioral issues. So we focus on the phone home part of the spyware issue. We're trying to block things going in, but of course if they're already in, the main issue now is to block any information trying to go to get out of the organization. So, and there are suspicious communications that you, even if you do not have the signatures or the rules, you know that what you see is suspicious. You know that what you see is something that you wanna block, even if you don't understand why. So, of course, there's always this issue of false positives with behavioral issues and so on. But that's one line of research for us. The other one relates also to the collaboration that I talked about before between security vendors and hopefully with the other players like the ISP. So there's a desktop vendor represented here in the audience, and I firmly believe that when we integrate our capabilities and we are able to update one another what we see in the gateway, what some other folks are seeing on the desktop, we are in a better position to detect, to block, and to remove spyware from the infrastructure, from the endpoints.
Thanks. Do you have any comments, Sean?
I think from a R&D perspective, there's not a single technological advance that will put an end to spyware. It's going to be a combination of things. Like ideally, if we can stop the spyware getting on there, stop it getting to the point of attempting to install, that would be perfect. But we're not going to get that because there's always going to be bugs in software. There's always going to be users as well that click various things. We can definitely improve in that area. And then the next step is during installation, can we block it then? And then the next step is assume it's somehow installed. Can we actually stop it running? Can we detect it? So I think there's improvements to be made in all of those areas.
Let me ask this question this way, which is, are we ever going to see an end, complete end to spyware, or is it just going to keep changing and becoming different on us, and that's the best we can hope for, is to minimize it? Go down the line there.
Sure. Right now, I don't think we're going to see it. I can't envisage an end to it, simply because even if we were able to remove all bugs from browser software, that kind of thing, it's, as we've talked about, especially in the first session, it's a user problem as much as anything. So I think that will, regardless of the levels of education you give your users, they'll still do dumb things.
As I said before, there are many aspects where I see similarities between spyware and terror, and one of them is the end of it. I mean, there's nothing like that in sight, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, even if we can develop a system that has no vulnerabilities, we've talked a lot about users and their ability and wanting to click on anything that pops up on the screen, but we also have to remember that there are malicious users that could be in your network. So if the criminal can't get in through the network, it's easy to go down and not easy, but hire someone, get them into your company, and have them and try to install it. So that's also an avenue that we haven't discussed yet.
I think the reality is you know, pretty much we're going to be managing the risk. We're going to be managing spyware, or you know, pick a problem. It's going to be a continual cat and mouse game. The best that we can do is manage and try to mitigate, and still reach for the long term solutions. But again, folks are going to take advantage of that as well. So there's other threats that are right around the horizon. So
yes. No, this is broader than, it includes keystroke loggers, and it does not include cookies, this study. You can look up, it's a National Cybersecurity Alliance study that they've been doing.
Again, the moving point
Right. Well, this gets at Ron's question from earlier. I mean, is the problem of the future going to be quantity, or is it going to be the quality of this spyware? I think you know that Ron made a good point there in his opening there. Do other people have viewpoints on that?
Well, no. I mean, I think it's definitely going to be quality, right? Because it's an evolution right now. So you have botnets out there and people going out and doing it. As it becomes more difficult to do it, only the more experienced or people with more impetus to want to do it are going to do it, and those are going to be your criminal element trying to make money.
Well, yeah, but you have adware companies making $42, $52 million a year. I mean, the less legitimate ones making $42, $52 million a year. You know, there's obviously financial incentive there if you can come up with a new business model that venture capitalists are willing to support.
And kind of skirt the lines of law.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I still think it's going to be more of the quality of it.
Anyone else want to venture, I guess?
As we talked about earlier, we may see that currently the desktop may be seen as low-hanging fruit. So as that becomes more locked down, then as we discussed, there may be proliferation of spyware on other platforms, so VoIP, mobile platforms. So it may just shift.
I'm just going to point out, you know, just like we saw the problem of, you know, speeding tickets, people don't speed anymore, right? So, I mean, you know, we're going to always have these challenges. That's why it comes back to managing risk within your environment. So. Well, it comes back down to, you know, what was just talked about with the sophistication. And again, you know, my earlier comment about some of the targeted activity, that's been a wake-up call for a lot of companies. I mean, some of these are Fortune 50, some are, you know, in the Fortune 500 realm. That was a wake-up call. You know, their proprietary information was, you know, being targeted. So, you know, that's, you know, it's not your general, you know, your typical consumer-based type, you know, spyware. It's when you start getting into the more sophisticated stuff and the more targeted type activity. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, as, you know, history has shown, you know, organizations react when some major event happens, and sometimes, you know, it's us knocking at the door saying, you've got a problem. So, you know, again, you know, it's a wake-up call for a lot of organizations. So, you know, and again, they'll ramp up, throw a lot of money, you know, do the security awareness, you know, and then, you know, things will, a period of time might settle back down and they'll fall back into some complacency. But again, you know, until the next big event. So, I mean, it seems like we keep getting stuck in that cycle. And, you know, there is a non-technical, you know, that you can keep doing awareness, but at some point, you know, folks do start to tune out. So I don't know, you know, if you got a solution for that, I'm all ears.
One last question.
Well, I cannot provide you with the education material, but what we recently provided the company, Drew talked before about transparency. I mean, one of the issues is really knowing what's going on in your network and having the users being aware of what's going on in their machine. Sometimes they're not really aware. So one way would be to bring into the network some way to mirror everything that's going on spy-wise in the network. In a recent financial company that we've been we demonstrated to the IT guys a keylogger that was installed in one of the more well-guarded parts of the organization. Now, it ended up being something that was installed by one of their employees who wanted to work from home, but bypassing all of the company guidelines and so on. But this is, I guess, one of the issues that Drew had in mind when he asked, okay, I don't know what's going on in my network. I don't know what sort of tools people are installing, people that I trust, but not necessarily are following the rules. So in general, I think that one of the best ways to make people aware is really just showing them the data, and there are tools, auditing tools, that can basically give a complete picture of spyware on the network, which machines are infected by what, and giving some feedback directly to the end users about what's installed on their machines, and even providing them with some guidance about what to do about it without having the IT guys dealing with 50 or 70,000 machines.
You know, as far as the certifying of a vendor, I think that was something you were asking about. Really, we got to rely upon work that the CDT does in trying to root out these, because it gets very complicated. And I don't know that the corporate, do we have enough resources to actually go through all the, you know, show me the entire chain and how, you know, our ads could possibly end up somewhere that they shouldn't be. You know, a lot of that probably would end up just in the contract and trying to reduce the risk to the vendor. If you do this, you'll get this penalty. But yeah, then also we talked about the trustee stuff earlier. The certifications of the of these vendors, I think, is going to. I think we'll see more of that going on.
That sounds like a good place to stop. Unless anyone else has a final comment.
Well, thank you very much. Good session. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.